you can wield a lot of influence if you keep it in the family or the tribe. The problem they found right away, and it became even more pronounced as time went on, is that nepotism is not a great formula for keeping an institution vibrant. You just can't keep promoting people because their father had the job. So the WASP, particularly after World War II, they knew their institutions to compete, to be competitive, to be first rate, needed to take in talented outsiders. And that was partly the drive to create a meritocratic-based system and to find supposedly more objective ways of measuring intelligence.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. If you wanted to be part of elite American society in the early and mid-20th century, you wanted to be a WASP. WASP is an acronym for White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but that's not really what it meant because just about everybody was in the early 20th century in the United States. It typically meant somebody who was part of the upper crust. You went to certain boarding schools, you went to Ivy League schools, and then you enjoyed a nepotism of being part of a club of other elite families that gave you a direct pathway to elite positions in American politics, in journalism, the business world. And this group dominated American society, culture, and politics for a lot of the history of the United States. WASPs produced brilliant reformers like Eleanor, Theodore, and Franklin Roosevelt. They inspired heroes of the Cold War like Dean Acheson and Joe Alsop. And they had a certain style and chic that drove characters like F. Scott Fitzgerald's Jay Gatsby mad with desire. They had flashing jewels, glittering soirees, great houses. And they had something that the rest of America craved. But by the 1960s and 1970s in the United States, they were seen as decadent and mostly caricatured. The millionaire on Gilligan's Island is one figure. By the 1980s, WASPs are basically the villains of slobs versus snobs comedies. And there's a truth to that. Some WASPs were sent to lunatic asylums or languished in nervous debility, and others committed suicide. So there are a lot of facets to WASP life. Today I'm speaking with Michael Knox Barron. He's the author of the new book, WASPs, The Splendors and Miseries of an American Aristocracy. We look at a group of characters who are driven by a vision of human completeness, one that distinguishes them from the self-complacency of more recent power establishments. So early WASPs, early elites in American society, built many of the philanthropic institutions that are important today. If you've been to a public library or been to a concert hall, that was probably funded by a WASP generations ago. So they shape the America in which we live, so it's not easy to understand our problems without a knowledge of their mistakes. And they also create a lot of the rigid social hierarchies that still affect American life today. But for all their faults, they pointed to the possibility of a new life. So there's a lot to unpack here, and understanding their story helps us understand American life in 2021. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Michael Barron. Michael, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Scott.
We're going to talk about an interesting group of people who played an outsized role, if not dominated the 20th century in the United States, and those are WASPs, White Anglo-Saxon Protestants. I'm familiar with the term, I'm sure most of my listeners are, but most, I would say, don't think of them as a group of people. It really is a stereotype of someone who wears polo shirts. They went to boarding schools and Ivy League colleges. They played polo. They are members of country clubs. They go to an Episcopalian church. They're a villain in an 80s screwball comedy like Meatballs or Bachelor Party. So for the starting point for WASP, or most people, are a caricature. Now, in your mind, because you have extensively researched this topic, I'm sure you would have a much more rounded vision of what that looks like. So before diving in and deconstructing this idea and then reconstructing it, what is your image of a WASP?
Well, I think that what you spoke about earlier, when the WASPs were sort of declining and falling from their high positions in American life, their establishment coming to grief, particularly over some of their misjudgments in Vietnam, it became easy for them to be stereotyped and in my generation, it would have been probably Thurston Howell and Gilligan's Island would have been the caricature you would have thought of, particularly the accent. It was the accent that non-rhotic, which means you don't pronounce the R in words like fear or Harvard. But it was the accent of Franklin Roosevelt, which had once stirred the country. And by the 1970s, 80s, it became a caricature. The original WASP, the group that I trace in my book, emerged after the Civil War. They were descended from earlier American elites, but they found themselves overshadowed by new groups of people who were usurping their places in the hierarchies, plutocrats, urban party bosses. And they felt impotent, they felt discouraged, they also felt a keen desire for, I don't know if it would be revenge, but to find their way back to positions of real prominence and calling the shots in American life. These would be characters like Henry Adams or Theodore Roosevelt, John Jay Chapman. And what I think is interesting is the way they reinvented themselves. Their beef with the America of the Gilded Age was not just with what they saw as the corruption and crassness of nouveau riche characters like the Vanderbilts. It was also in part a feeling that with the growth of industrial civilization, something was changing in human character, where their ancestors, some of the founding fathers, for example, had been sort of broad-souled civic characters, not confined to any one profession, but dabbling in all kinds of things. By the time the WASPs reinvent themselves in the 1880s, it was much different. You had to specialize quite microscopically. And they felt very much that this was sort of stunting to human character. Their idea was that if you had a certain kind of education, you would develop your various powers and become sort of a civic generalist who could both succeed in a profession, but also take a leadership role in civic life and government. And they produced a succession of reformers who did exactly that. The Roosevelts are probably the most famous, but Henry Stimson or Learned Hand, the literary critic Edmund Wilson, they're all examples of people that really overcame narrowness. And I think my final definition of a WASP is somebody that really wanted to keep the idea of sort of human completeness alive in a narrower age.
Hmm. Well, the acronym White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, each of those terms have a meaning that has changed throughout the decades and what that meant following the Civil War.
The term of WASP is just ridiculous sociological.
Right.
It's just completely overbroad. I mean, the people I'm talking about at that time in the United States, 80% of the country was WASPs. I mean, it really means absolutely nothing. Louis Auchincloss used to deplore it. He said, it's just ridiculous. It's so overbroad. The WASPs, as we come to think of them, that represented the sort of 20th century WASP establishment, the Roosevelts, Averell Harriman, Dean Acheson, McGeorge Bundy, that was just a very small cast of characters descended mainly from families in New York and Boston, and they were mostly related to each other. They went to the same schools, the same colleges, belonged to the same clubs. They had a whole network, but it's a very small microscopic group. So white Anglo-Saxon, I mean, first of all, Anglo-Saxon, what the hell does that even mean in the 20th century? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Well, I'm curious about the term because, of course, that term emerges decades after this group identity forms. And once you get into the 1960s, perhaps the preeminent quote-unquote WASP, JFK, is not two out of those three things. He's of Irish background, he's Catholic.
Well, he would never have thought of himself as a WASP.
Right.
But he did. He was educated in WASP institutions and got along with them brilliantly. And they, by this time, the WASPs are sort of losing their momentum. And they really found in Jack Kennedy somebody that shared their, what I guess we would now call their values, even though he didn't consider himself one. And it was a bit of a love-hate relationship. I mean, he really enjoyed the company of a lot of them, was close friends. His inner circle was filled with WASPs. His wife, though not a WASP, was the stepdaughter of Hugh Auchincloss, deeply embedded in the WASP family relationships. But at the same time, Kennedy certainly remembered all the times when the WASPs had dissed his own ancestors, and he enjoyed ribbing them some of the time about that.
Well, those particular terms, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, although, I mean, it's a bit ridiculous. Could you speak to those three different identities, white, Anglo-Saxon, and Protestant, and what they individually mean.
Yeah, I mean, Anglo-Saxon's a tribe 1,000 years ago. I don't know, you might want to call them English, but the English, of course, are made up of lots of strains besides Anglo-Saxon. I would say the Wasps would probably more resemble the Normans in England than the Anglo-Saxon, because they did have sort of a corrosive blood pride. They like to give orders. And their Protestantism, too, again, that's a hugely broad thing. I don't know that it particularly distinguishes them. They were more Anglican or Episcopalian than other denominations, but it was hardly the key thing about them. I just don't think, it's just a name that's, you can't get rid of because it's there, but it really makes no sense.
Well, there's a somewhat clear tribal identity of the main figures who produced this identity in your book. So could you mention briefly their emergence, but can you speak more to that? What led to their emergence and sort of the, I guess you could say, the height of their influence and powers when they were at their peak?
Well, you have a group of people who are descended from, take Henry Adams, from, you know, his grandfather and his great-grandfather were presidents of the United States. Now, he finds himself in a different position. I think when he was young, he would have liked to have become president, but it wasn't going to happen. He was not adept at manipulating the new machinery of power that emerged after the Civil War. But his idea and that of Roosevelt and a Peabody was that what you could do is if you took young people and sort of trained them up at a young age, got them interested in developing different sets of skills, didn't set their mind so much on just succeeding in one single profession, but just urge them to take a place in public life to contribute to the community. They were going to sort of create this sort of cast of public service oriented people who are going to have power, but they were going to use it for good ends. They really thought there was going to be sort of a nobility in their public service, and it worked. Their schools did produce an extraordinary group of civic leaders. I think Theodore and Franklin Roosevelt are by far the most famous, but all kinds of lesser figures who served under them and had a great impact on the country, not just the political institutions, but running things like the State Department, which was a WASP preserve. The leading banks and law firms were WASP dominated. Charities, foundations, colleges, prep schools. It was a whole institutional structure that the WASPs dominated. It had a huge impact on American life from Theodore Roosevelt's day and his reforms through Vietnam, which was sort of the last gasp of the WASPs.
Right. I mean, there's a clear trajectory here where you mentioned the Roosevelts, and you could probably speak more to the breakpoints, whether it's before or after World War II. But there's a description in your book that I think captures this, and I'd love to hear you elaborate. You write that they were creatures of glamour, power, and privilege, living amid the splendor of great houses, flashing jewels, and glittering soirees. Envied and lampooned, they had something the rest of America craved. Yet they were unhappy, descended from families that created the United States. WASPs felt themselves stunted by a civilization that thwarted their higher aspirations at every turn. They were the original lost generation, adrift in the waters of the Gilded Age. Some were sent to lunatic asylums or languished in nervous debility. Others committed suicide. So can you speak to some of these figures? Like, who do you think really exemplified, let's say pre-World War II, kind of like the best virtues of people who wanted to use their prestige and power to influence society in a positive way, which pre-World War II, this idea seems to be working better, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I think the domestic reforms were largely probably Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt. I suppose they were the two most exemplary WASP public servants, the two most influential. They both were important figures in the progressive reform movement. Theodore Roosevelt began expanding federal power to regulate different aspects of American life, food and drugs, things like that, corporations. And he proposed, after he was president, the establishment of a modern welfare state. It didn't happen. He didn't win in 1912 when he ran for president. But his program was pretty much implemented by Franklin Roosevelt during the New Deal. So I think those would be your exemplary public figures. But there was also a lot of private philanthropy, WASPs doing good in sort of NGO type ways. Vita Scudder, a professor at Wellesley, who started the settlement house movement in America, in which young WASP women would go into inner cities and set up settlement houses and try and raise up the urban poor, not just feed them and clothe them or help them out with that kind of thing, but it was really supposed to be a project in which they would help educate them and expose them to books and the humanities. The Watts had a great faith in humane or liberal education, and this caught on. Eleanor Roosevelt got her start in philanthropy and settlement house work in New York.
Yeah, this is an interesting time period. There are a lot of the institutions that promote education in the United States come from these figures. There are the creation of public libraries, but also cities that were growing rapidly in the Gilded Age, but are now part of the Rust Belt, the Cincinnati's or further east, the Baltimore's, they'll still have opera houses and other things that were created by endowments, many by these figures, which even if the city's population has fallen precipitously since the early 20th century, they still have these institutions left over. And one thing you write is that these characters are driven by a vision of human completeness, that there's some sort of idea that you can lift up all sorts of classes with these types of things. So what is the idea and what sort of goal did figures like these have? Was it like early 20th century progressivism that we're going to like eliminate poverty, we're going to universalize education, or what kind of vision do you see in these different people?
The WASPs that I'm describing in the book, there was always a tension between pure Wall Street WASPs and reform WASPs. They might coexist in the same person with different dimensions of their career. Somebody like Henry Stimson was a very successful lawyer in Wall Street practice, but he also took time out to be a reforming United States attorney, bringing antitrust cases in the Southern District of New York. He then would go on to serve as Secretary of War, Secretary of State, a variety of other positions. So there is you have reformers who are also Wall Street figures. Learned Hand worked in private practice in New York before becoming a judge and becoming very active in Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose reform campaign. So yes, you did have WASPs who, while they were connected to Wall Street, were also trying to reform it.
Well, I think the caricature you were talking about earlier with WASPs and the figure from Gilligan's Island, they're not these trailblazing figures who accumulate their own wealth or pass it on to the next generation. But over the generations, as more wealth is accumulated in the new business climate of the United States, generation over generation, these patterns emerge. The nature of this new aristocratic class solidifies and hardens. And then you get people who didn't really earn their wealth. They inherit it over multiple generations. So can you speak to some of these figures that I think are closer to the stereotype of the WASP? One in particular I thought was very interesting from your book is Francis Sedgwick. So can you tell me his story?
Well, Francis Sedgwick is, to the extent that he's known today, is known as the father of Edie Sedgwick, Andy Warhol's muse or something of that nature. But he was part of the very intricately connected WASP establishment. He went to Groton, was in the Porcellian Club at Harvard, and there was some inherited money, but not much. So he followed the familiar tradition of the eligible WASP male marrying an heiress, a DeForest, whose father was a railroad bigwig. And Fuzzy Sedgwick was able to sort of live off that wealth and create a sort of dukedom in California where he could pursue the WASP ideal of developing all aspects of your nature. He was a sculptor. He wrote fiction. He ranched. He was out in the saddle all day. But he was also crazy, and he embodies another aspect of the WASP story. A lot of what they called neurasthenia in their family history, despair, depression, that sort of thing. And a lot of what they did in life was trying to escape the funks in which a lot of them fell. Fuzzy Sedgwick was one of these guys. He never really achieved what he wanted to, and his personal life became in some ways pretty sort of unpleasant. And he was definitely, I think, belonged to what another WASP poet, Robert Lowell, when he spoke of Mayflower screwballs. Well, that was Fuzzy Sedgwick, but that was a lot of WASP. That was Theodore Roosevelt's younger brother, Elliot Roosevelt, who, when they were young, sort of outshone Theodore in some ways, looked like a very promising person, but he He drank himself to death at a young age, leaving his daughter Eleanor Roosevelt an orphan. But there were all these sort of skeletons in the closet, and that, I think, motivated, was an additional spur on WASPs to really try and do something with their lives, else they were going to just end up sitting around their club, living on inherited money, and drinking themselves to death.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. And something interesting, I think, with this topic, I always in the show try to take the themes of whatever the book topic is and connect it to larger themes in history. And it seems that part of what can cause a society to decay is the sense that the upper class and the interests of the upper class are detached from the rest of the population. If the upper class is benefiting the rest of society, then that's a good, vibrant society. If they're an aristocracy whose concerns are divorced from everyone else's and they're parasites that prey on lower classes, the way that medieval society can be critiqued, or France on the eve of the French Revolution, that or the Soviet Union in its later stages when you had the party members and everyone else. So in terms of one aspect of this, this caricature of this sheltered elite society is that it's really self-contained. It only exists to look after its own interests, and it's really impossible to gain admittance. So if I wanted to become a WASP, what was that process like?
Well, I mean, the Vanderbilts were looked down upon by Edith Wharton and the WASP, but they, within a generation, they were fully assimilated. So there was no barrier to entry except probably poverty, but or not having enough money. But if you had enough money, you'd eventually be admitted into WASP society unless you were extremely unpleasant and didn't follow the rules. But the point about being out of touch, I think the original WASP were very conscious of the problem of having a lot of privilege in a society where people were poor and going hungry. I think they saw that it was to the advantage of the upper class to show sympathy for people whose lot in life was very different. I think that was a lot of what Theodore Roosevelt's reform projects were about. It was certainly crucial to Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt. I think they were, even though their lives were very different from the people whom they wanted to help, I think that they were conscious that an elite is not going to survive if it's not taking into account people that aren't doing as well in society.
Right, especially figures after World War II, when it seems there are WASPs who are trying to sort of inject their society with new blood, pursuit of outsiders they thought could either give them some new relevancy. So can you describe what that looked like?
Well, their power, as we talked about Henry Adams' generation and the Gilded Age, they wanted to find a way to, again, become a power in the state and have a great deal of influence. And we talked about their schools and their education was part of it, but so was cronyism. If you marry within the same group, keep the money together, you're going to have power, and you're going to decide when there's the vacancy, whether it's in the State Department or the law firm or the bank, you're going to give it to somebody whom you know, who you're related to. And you can wield a lot of influence if you keep it in the family or the tribe. The problem they found right away, and it became even more pronounced as time went on, is that nepotism is not a great formula for keeping an institution vibrant. You just can't keep promoting people because their father had the job. So the WASPs, particularly after World War II, they knew their institutions to compete, to be competitive, to be first rate, needed to take in talented outsiders. And that was partly the drive to create a meritocratic-based system and to find supposedly more objective ways of measuring intelligence. And Henry Chauncey, who ironically was a legacy at both Groton Boarding School and at Harvard, was a key figure in developing the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT, which did as much as anything to break the WASP monopoly on the Ivy League, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and open it up to talent. So that really was the beginning of the end of sort of the WASP ascendancy, is when you now have people rising up because they're smart or they do better on the test than the next guy or the next person.
Well, the institutions that you could say created WASP, perhaps they created, that perpetuated their existence, the corporations, Ivy Leagues, boarding schools, all those things, many of those still exist today, but what you describe, the idea of the WASPs declined. So what did the process of their decline and fall look like?
The institutions are still there, the boarding schools, the Ivy League. It's just that they're meritocratic now. And you might have a slight preference as a legacy at some of these places, but it counts for less and less. And they're now pretty much fully meritocratic institutions. Yes, there are WASPs in them, but there are all kinds of people in them. And they all performed well enough on the, you know, they cleared the hurdles you need to clear to get into an Ivy League college. So, but the institutions, yes, they're all there. It's just a meritocracy, not a sort of WASP nepotistic insider system. Even the clubs are now meritocratic. There might be a few. I think it came out with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Bailey's Beach in Rhode Island. That's a very old WASP institution. That may still, there are a few places that have, I suppose, real closed doors to outsiders, or at least outsiders who haven't worked really hard to get in. But that's becoming much more the exception than the rule. The meritocracy is dominant.
So what did the decline and fall of these WASP families, WASP as a social unit, look like? Did a name not carry the same currency in the 1970s and 1980s as it would in the 1940s? So what did this decline and fall look like?
No, it didn't. Franklin Roosevelt's, his most talented, or thought to be most talented, political son, the one that had his father's charm, Franklin Roosevelt Jr., when he went to run for office in New York in the 1950s, he already found that the Roosevelt name was not enough, and he didn't succeed in winning high office in New York State. The name was no longer enough. And certainly as time went by, yes, you can be a WASP and be in politics, Weld or John Kerry, but you do it mainly because you're skillful enough on your own merits. It's not, people aren't voting for you because of your, if anything, it's a hurdle WASPs have to overcome, which, you know, you see the Bushes, for example, running away from their WASP heritage, you know, trying to be Texan because they know being a WASP is not going to really serve their interests with voters.
Right. There's a interesting tie-in with the Bush family, and I think a character on The Simpsons where there's a Texan character and you find out later he's actually from Connecticut and grew up in boarding schools, which is a play on, I think, Bush 41 or Bush 43, that he had this image as a Texan, but had an extremely elite upbringing, and the Bush family could be about as WASPy as you think of.
Well, yes, the Bushes, I mean, both President Bushes had the WASP education, Andover, Yale, skull and bones at Yale. But Bush 41 went out west and pursued his career there. But he didn't actually win statewide office in Texas. So even then, it was hard. I mean, he lost his Senate race to Lloyd Benson, 68 or 70. He came up really through administrative positions, head of the CIA and things like that, Reagan's vice president. He actually was one of those WASPs that didn't have quite the common touch with voters. That was another problem for WASPs. Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt were sort of unique in being magnetic and appealing to people all across the country in spite of their accents and their rarefied upbringing. But most WASPs, Averell Harriman, George Bush, Cabot Lodge, they were sort of awkward with voters. They felt they were brought up to be sort of not to brag about themselves or to talk about themselves too much. That's something you don't do as a WASP. It's not good breeding to be blowing your own horn and everything. So they find it very awkward to sort of sell themselves to the public. You know, Coriolanus in Shakespeare's play, he's the same thing. He doesn't like to stand up in front of the plebs and advertise himself. They weren't good at retail politics, with the exception of the Roosevelts. They did much of their service in appointed positions. Henry Stimson was one of the country's most distinguished public servants. He was quite a man. He, as an old man in his 70s, he led the War Department in the Second World War, working for Franklin Roosevelt, even though Stimson himself was a Republican. But he only ran for public office once when he ran for governor of New York, and he lost. He just had no ability to appeal to the voter.
Well, I'm curious about where WASPs play sort of in the pantheon of America's elite over American history, because on the one hand, it's easy to be snarky and dismissive. We began this podcast talking about deconstructing the archetype because that's how many people understand them. And from the vantage point of 2021, you think this is a class that was nepotistic. The very meaning of the term focuses on race. It focuses on religious identity, which doesn't fly today. But it's too simple to just dismiss them because we pointed to their good qualities. And maybe we can take both of these, the good and the bad, and to introduce the good qualities, or no, let's start with the bad and then go for the good. I think that's maybe a better way to look at. So compared to today's elite society, which could be leaders of corporations, Silicon Valley, tech startup leaders, what we think of the 21st century elite, what were qualities that you think WASPs lacked compared to today's elite class?
I think they were probably less in touch with the country as a whole, with the way their lives. Today, somebody that's a billionaire often grew up sort of in regular circumstances and knows what it's like. But somebody like the Roosevelts, I mean, there was never a day when they didn't have servants. And so their lives were extremely different. So I think they were more out of touch with the life of the average person. Franklin Roosevelt was sort of, when Eleanor during World War I wrote a book about how she was economizing the household with the help of the 10 family servants and had it published in the paper, Franklin immediately saw how out of touch that looked with the country. And he said, yes, I want to share, get this published, Eleanor, how your idea of the new household economy for millionaires. That'll definitely be a help in my public career. So they were more out of touch than today's elite. And they were probably less open to technical innovations in society, those kinds of changes. They weren't as technically adept, and a lot of them, their sort of STEM education was probably pretty pathetic to the kinds of people that are in leadership positions today. I think that was another drawback. And finally, they did get where they were. Even the talented ones had all kinds of strings pulled for them to get where they were. And I think what you could admire about a lot of people today is they are much more self-made in that tradition of Horatio Alger, Abraham Lincoln. But we were going to get to how they're better, right, than the current people. They have broader interests. They have a highly developed civic conscience. Their classical education gave them a great sense of history. And they're not the narrow, specialized technocrats today whose interest when they made the money is just, it's sort of, you know, rocket ships and spaceships. And they're much more narrow and boorish, I think. A figure like Joe Alsop, or Learned Hand, or Edmund Wilson.
So when I was thinking about your book, there was another book that came to mind. It was by Frank Schaefer. It came out in 2006, and it's called AWOL: The Unexcused Absence of America's Upper Classes from Military Service and How It Hurts Our Country. And the point of the book is that the British aristocracy disproportionately died in World War I. And one of the effects of World War I is that in different nations, it actually wiped out a lot of the aristocracy and led to incredible social change because the aristocratic elite saw it as their duty to serve in warfare. And this book argues that with Iraq and Afghanistan, most of the elites are derelict in their duty. They're not on the front lines in really any capacity. And today's technocratic elites, maybe they went to the Ivy League, maybe they didn't, but their fates are really linked to global corporations or starting corporations that go global. And there's really no vested interest in, let's say, the fate of the United States. Whereas earlier Gilded Age figures or robber barons, if nothing else, their vices were tied to the fate of the United States. So if they did well, hopefully their workers would do well, although they were, some would argue, predatory to labor union workers. But today, there's not really that same kind of sense of fate that someone's stock options could do incredibly well, but then they would downsize their company and offshore tech support to India or factory workers to Vietnam or Mexico or elsewhere, and be happy to leave entire villages or entire towns in the Rust Belt, just kind of be left to their fate. So what do you hope are maybe like things that can be learned from history for how the WASP did do well as an aristocratic elite?
Well, in World War I and World War II, they were on the front lines. They did volunteer in numbers greater than probably the proportional to, they even before we were in World War I, they were signing up to go fight with England and France against Germany. And same in World War II. You look at Theodore Roosevelt's son, who was an old man at that point, dying, not killed in action, but dying of a heart attack in Normandy. The fact that he was at Normandy and in France after D-Day, even though he was an old man with a bad heart, shows they were certainly not all Theodore Roosevelt's boys were in the war, and Quentin was killed. So they were not like today's elites that avoid military service. No, they were very different there. They were much more like the British in World War One in signing up and going to fight.
So by understanding the contributions, but also the problems that this class had in American history, how do you hope readers can have a different understanding of their place in it and what was gained, but also what was lost when they disappeared?
Well, I think what they do stand for is, as we've talked about, this idea of human completeness. And it is a real issue that, well, everybody faces, but we face it particularly in America today. We live at a sort of frenetic pace. We have to get on in a career. You really, these days, you do have to specialize. You do have to sort of pursue a sort of narrow groove to make a success of your career. There are all these sort of encouragements to develop just one or two sides of your personality, which can lead to success, but which can be stunting and unfulfilling in other ways. So I think that WASP notion that you should try to develop different aspects of your power, your abilities, find other outlets just besides getting ahead at work, that is, I think, a valuable lesson to sort of do justice to yourself. I think that's what the WASPs were about. They really wanted to do it. Now, of course, they had it much easier than most of the rest of us do, because if you've got an inherited income, if you can get over, have enough self-discipline not just to sit around your club, you have more opportunities to do different things than somebody that has, you know, needs to make their living in a 9-to-5 job. It's still the idea, which they sort of got from the Athenians, that a worthwhile life is going to be one where you do develop your various powers. I think that is still it can be an inspiration for us today.
Well, this is a very important perspective of understanding some of the most influential people in the 19th and 20th centuries. And it wasn't just them as individuals, but the class that came out of. So, I mean, this adds a lot of context to many of the topics I've discussed on the show. Well, for listeners who want to check out more, the name of the book is WASPs, The Splendors and Miseries of an American Aristocracy. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.